I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. Communicable diseases are all around us. They range from the simple common cold to more serious illnesses, such as Ebola. One of these is dominating the news cycle. The other is not. Today, we'll find out why. Infectious disease specialists Colleen Johnson and Roberta Sturm and Knox County Health Department Director Martha Buchanan will join me to explore what we know about infectious diseases. We'll also talk about what you can do to stay healthy in the cold and flu season. We'll talk about the anti-vaccination movement and what we in the press can do to better report on topics related to infectious disease. Join us for Dialogue after this news. Six minutes after 1 o'clock on this Wednesday, the day after Election Day 2014, is the 5th of November. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with you for another installment of Dialogue. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, as you heard in our open just about 5 or 6 minutes ago, we're talking about communicable diseases. And it may range from the mundane, the stuff that we deal with all the time, like the regular cold and flu season, which we're about to enter, to something more exotic like Ebola, which has been in the headlines now for several weeks in the U.S. All of those things affect us in one way or another. But what we want to get to in the course of this hour is what we need to know, how we know it, and what you can do to be a more savvy consumer of the news that you may be hearing all over the place. So joining us to help sort through some of those questions today, Martha Buchanan. She's the director of the Knox County Health Department. Good afternoon, Dr. Buchanan.
Afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Indeed. Emergency preparedness epidemiologist with the Knox County Health Department. Roberta Sturm is with us as well in the studio.
Good afternoon.
And joining us on the phone from her office at the University of Louisville, Colleen Johnson. She is an infectious disease specialist. And Dr. Johnson, I mispronounced your name in the open. I apologize for that, but it is Johnson.
Thank you.
Yes,
indeed. Glad to be here.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us. Well, we're going to begin this hour with what's in the news cycle right now. We begin with Ebola because that is what's in the headlines. So I think it's important to point out that while Ebola is a serious illness in terms of its effects on the human body, the chances that any one of you listening today will contract it are extremely, almost infinitesimally small. So we'll walk through this topic to begin the show, starting with where the disease stands now in the U.S. We've had only a few confirmed cases out of a total population of the country, about 330 million. Dr. Buchanan, talk to us about what we know right now about the situation.
Well, what we know about Ebola in the U.S., Brandon, is that we have 8 confirmed cases or so, all of whom have had direct contact with someone else who had Ebola, most of whom had been in West Africa, either in Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea, caring for people with Ebola, or folks who've cared for people here in the United States afterwards who became ill. So they've had direct contact. We don't have any cases of people who haven't had direct contact with someone who is currently ill with Ebola, and we don't have active transmission just being passed from person to person to person. We don't have that in the United States. So going about your everyday life, there's really no risk of Ebola for you in the United States, and really very little risk with travel unless you're going to go to one of those West African countries and care for somebody who has Ebola.
And Ms. Sturm, I know this is something you've been focusing on as an emergency preparedness epidemiologist at KCHD. This is an important point to make, that it's something that can be transmitted only through very specific means. This is not the kind of thing you get when somebody coughs next to you on the bus or you sit in the same airplane seat where somebody was sitting. Talk to us a little bit more about the specific method of contact.
Sure. The method of contact, I mean, someone actually has to come in contact with blood and body fluids. Body fluids such as sweat, urine, blood, vomit, fecal matter. It's not something that if someone coughs, you can get it. If someone sneezes, you can get it. It actually takes a little bit more than that to be able to catch this virus.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Johnson, we want to turn to you for just a moment, because with some illnesses, some bacteria, some viruses, your body's own antibodies can help you develop an immunity to a certain kind of illness. Is it possible for humans to build an immunity to a virus like Ebola? What's the story on that?
Yeah. I think the one of the first patients, I don't really know his name, but the photographer, right?
For NBC News, the freelancer they had? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
he developed antibodies to the virus, and they were actually able to use his, basically his antibodies available in his sera to treat other patients, as I understand it, if they were the same blood type.
Yeah. One of the things that's been often reported as this case is talked about in cable news and online is that there is no effective vaccine for Ebola. So talk to us about some of the treatment options and why it's so difficult to create a vaccine for this illness. That's you, Dr. Johnson.
Yeah, you know, certainly working with Ebola virus requires special containment conditions. And those containment conditions are referred to as biosafety level 4, otherwise known as BSL-4.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything that we do has with that virus, that live virus, has to be conducted in that live containment, with that live virus has to be conducted in level 4. And up until a couple of years ago, there were only, I guess, two biosafety level 4 facilities in the United States, one at CDC and one at USAMRID.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were very few individuals actually able to work on these viruses. After 9/11, two additional facilities were built, one in Galveston, Texas, mm-hmm. at UTMB, and the other in Boston. And that one in Boston has just, I believe, recently opened. So we are behind on Ebola vaccines, not necessarily because they're difficult, although all vaccine work is difficult, but also a big part of that is because we haven't had the facilities to conduct that work.
Until very recently, it sounds like.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Now, Ebola has been reported to have symptoms that, at least in its early stages, resemble symptoms of the flu, and in its very early stages. And since we're headed into flu season, I think it's important to talk about some of the big differences between a seasonal flu and having something as serious as Ebola. So Dr. Buchanan, as somebody who works in community health and health with large groups of people, what would you say about that? How can we tell the difference?
Well, first, the really easy way to tell the difference is, have they been exposed to Ebola or not? Because mm-hmm. you have to be exposed very directly to Ebola to get it. So if there's been no travel to one of the three countries, no care of someone who has Ebola, then your fever and body aches and malaise are probably due to something else. So that's one way. And then, of course, pretty rapidly they diverge. Ebola is really a gastrointestinal or GI illness with mm-hmm. vomiting and diarrhea, and then also affects other organs in the end stages, where the flu is really a respiratory illness. So it's going to be a cough. It's going to be a fever. It's going to be runny nose and sore throat. You really don't have many of those symptoms with Ebola. But the big difference there is, get that travel information. Have they been exposed? If they haven't been exposed, their fever is not Ebola. It might be flu. It might be something else.
Sure. Well, is that a potential of concern for both of you, Ms. Sturm and Dr. Buchanan, working with the public and working with hospitals, that you're going to see emergency rooms and doctor's offices and the health department getting clogged with a lot of people who have the flu because it's that time of year, but think they've got Ebola? Is that a concern in your mind?
Absolutely. Anytime there's a lot of media surrounding an illness, we do see an increased volume in calls. But in this instance, we have worked with our primary care physicians and our emergency departments, and we've gotten that information out on what questions to ask. You know, have you traveled to these specific countries in West Africa,
right.
Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone? Have you been there in the past month? To kind of help coordinate that and also help to alleviate fears that people might have when they do come in with flu or a flu-like illness.
Mm-hmm. So let me pose this question then to all three of you, because I think it's interesting. And Dr. Johnson, we'll begin with you. From your seat, then, what concerns you the most? Is it the Ebola itself or the public reaction to Ebola? Which do you think is the bigger issue?
I think that my concern is in, it's always hard to say these things sort of politely, but I think is my concern is in our infrastructure, mm-hmm. For public health. I think that this is really highlighted the challenges that the WHO faces now. In 1995, when they had the first outbreak of Ebola, they were on the scene and they were able to manage that particular situation. And over the years, since 1995, the WHO's budget hasn't really increased, and they rely heavily on public funding. And so I believe 80% of their funding comes from private donations. So if anything, it points to a need to have a global health network that is sustained and can react and put in place what we need at that time versus 4 or 5 months later. As I understand it, we have troops going in now. It's October, and this began when? In March?
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a bit of time has passed.
Definitely. And Dr. Buchanan, as Dr. Johnson was talking, I saw you nodding in agreement with some of the problems, the issues they're facing the WHO. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Right. And she's absolutely correct. We need a sustainable global approach to these kinds of global issues, global health issues. If we take a closer look locally, certainly I think the risk of Ebola in this country, the risk of Ebola specifically in Knox County, is so very low. Not zero, but so very low that it's really all the misinformation and all the anxiety that's out there that really is something that we really want to try to shed light on and provide the facts for. That's really a concerning piece. I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that 30,000 people die from flu every year in this country.
Right.
And flu season's upon us, and Ebola is an issue, but it's not the most common thing that people are going to get in the United States this year.
That's an excellent point, and it's what we'll be talking about in the next portion of our program, because we are coming up on cold and flu season, something that's definitely worth talking about. So why don't we pause, Greg, a little bit early for this break, and we'll come back. We'll do cold and flu season with our guests, Dr. Colleen Johnson of the University of Louisville. We'll have Martha Buchanan of the Knox County Health Department, the director, and emergency preparedness epidemiologist Roberta Sturm. We'll all be back with you. We'll open up the phone lines, too, for your questions about cold and flu season coming up in just a moment. Right now, it's 17 and a half after. It is Dialogue from WUOT News. Marching, I suppose, into our second portion of the program today on Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Thanks for joining us here on WUOT 91.9 FM. And we're back with our guests talking about communicable diseases here on this Wednesday afternoon. Well, we covered Ebola and the seriousness of that, but again, the more common concern, and this is something Dr. Buchanan alluded to just a moment ago, more common in terms of deaths, more common in terms of its transmission, and more common in terms of the way that we just deal with it in our lives. It's cold and flu season coming up. And you mentioned this, 33,000 people on average die each year from the influenza. Let's kind of use a bridge point from Ebola. Before we do, by the way, let me remind our listeners, you can call in with your questions at 974-5050. You can also tweet your questions at WUOTFM on Twitter or go to facebook.com/WUOTFM, submit them on Facebook. So using the bridge to get from Ebola to our more common sort of concerns here in the U.S. about cold and flu season. We've seen all the media attention, the concern, everybody's worried about Ebola, but you have this illness that does kill thousands of Americans every year that we don't seem to be quite as concerned about. Dr. Buchanan, why don't we seem to be as afraid of the flu?
Well, I think it's the familiarity issue. You know, we get the flu every year, comes around, oh yeah, it's flu season, and Dr. Buchanan's going to be talking about getting my flu shot. Mm-hmm. And we just become complacent. Because maybe we don't know anybody who died from it. It's not grabbing the headlines. And so we kind of forget about it, or we don't want to get vaccinated, or we just run out of time and neglect getting vaccinated. I think it's that complacency issue of just, it's the flu again, no big deal. I had it once. It was not a big deal. Because, you know, a lot of people don't know somebody who's died from the flu, but certainly people do die from the flu. So,
you know, it's interesting to point out, too, I think the last time I had a full-blown influenza, I was a senior in high school. And so it's been a long, long time. But that doesn't mean that I'm immune to it. Dr. Johnson, there are different kinds of influenza. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's what we saw a couple of years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
We saw that people became infected with the 2009 pandemic influenza, had it had a broader distribution and much more severity. And the reason for that was we hadn't seen that particular strain of influenza, the H1N1 in that particular case.
And I'll just add to that, you know, the influenza virus changes slightly each year, and the combination of which viruses cause the flu every year, which strains are in the flu that are causing disease around the world, change every year. So that's why you got to get your flu shot every year, is because the virus is just a little bit different. And so you need a new vaccine to protect you from that particular strain that's circulating this year in the flu season.
And Dr. Yeah. Buchanan, I believe there are, is it the this year the vaccines are either trivalent or quadrivalent, is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, as the non-doctor in the room, what does that mean, trivalent or quadrivalent, and why does that matter?
Dr. Buchanan, I'll go ahead.
So each year the flu vaccine contains three separate strains of the flu virus,
okay.
Two A strains and one B strain. This last year they decided to add another B strain, so now it's two A strains and two B strains of the flu, and virus strains are named by letters and numbers, and it's kind of complicated. But so they create the flu virus based on what's circulating in other parts of the world, and then start manufacturing it to have it ready for fall flu season.
So let me ask this then: if I get my flu shot, or when I get my flu shot very shortly, I'm being inoculated against four different strains. Is that correct?
Potentially, yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware that's how that worked. The most commonly, I guess, strains, like you said, the ones that seem to be in wide circulation at any given flu season. How do you predict what flu is going to be en vogue this fall? How do you know?
I am glad you asked
okay,
that question.
Okay, take it, Ms. Sturm.
We do have a program in place called the Sentinel Provider Network in Tennessee, and it's part of CDC's ILINet, and it's an influenza surveillance system.
Mm.
And we have participating providers in our community that regularly submit specimens to the CDC for testing. Anyone that presents with influenza-like illness, such as fever greater than 100 degrees, with the presence of a cough and or sore throat. They take those specimens, send them to CDC, and not only does that help them determine what is circulating, but the burden of illness in the community.
Oh, that's really, so you're talking about the incidence as well, like how prevalent a particular strain might be within a community.
That's correct.
Very interesting. Dr. Johnson, who are some of the groups that are most at risk for catching and maybe seeing severe effects from the flu?
From my understanding of the literature, the elderly are particularly susceptible because they're not making those immune responses as they did when they were younger. And as well, women who are pregnant can be what we call immune compromised.
Mm.
And so they can be in particular susceptible. Young children are also more susceptible probably to influenza. And this was particularly seen, you know, when we see new strains emerge, right? So again, going back to that 2009 pandemic, there were more children that were affected. In the normal seasonal influenzas, we don't see that many. So,
and Dr. Buchanan, I know the county health department is involved in helping inoculate people against the flu. How do you usually plot that out? What's the strategy for getting Knox County and other areas ready for the flu season?
Well, locally, our biggest strategy is to vaccinate the kids, because we see historically that children frequently introduce infectious diseases, in particular the flu, into the community. And there are several studies that support if you vaccinate children and protect them from getting the flu, you will reduce the total flu burden in your community and even hospitalizations and deaths in your community from the flu each year by doing that. In addition to that, we look back historically and, you know, just order vaccine based on historic use and make it widely available throughout the community. And, you know, honestly, the great thing about vaccinations now is that they really are available everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Walgreens has them, CVS has them, Kroger's has them, and I'm happy they do, because they're more, you know, they have more convenient hours than we do. And so I frequently say I don't care who gives you a flu shot as long as you get one.
Well, and that's an interesting point to bring up, too, as we head into this season in which a lot of people are going to be getting sick and all of us are kind of cooped up indoors, where diseases are transmitted a little more easily through contagious methods here. When you talk about this strategy to vaccinate a community, is that something that you find is that the demand fluctuates. And what I'm getting at here is that in years where we're not really thinking a whole lot about infectious diseases, you get only a few people, comparatively speaking, who get the flu shot. But in other years, like now, with Ebola in the headlines, maybe we're thinking more about diseases in general. I better get my flu shot. Do we see that there's any kind of effect in how people are talking about diseases and how many of them are interested in getting vaccinated?
Going back to the 2009 pandemic, when that was all over the media, we did our call volume. We had to open up a phone bank because there was so much interest in when does that vaccine come out and when can I get it? Whereas it was different from other flu seasons where, it, like you said, it was just a general, oh, you know, it's flu season. So we did, I don't know specific numbers, but
right.
I do know that the interest was there and that the community really did want to make sure that they were vaccinated.
Yeah. And Dr. Johnson, anything to add to that, talking about rates of vaccination or anything based on what you've learned?
I would leave it to the professionals. That wouldn't be my necessarily my expertise. So
fair enough. Mine either. That's why we're both learning today.
Yeah, exactly.
So, let's move on just a little bit to the common cold, a disease so mundane that it's called the common cold. I mean, this is something, though, that's a little different because it tends to mutate as well. I mean, this is not something you can get a cold all the time. There are different varieties of it all over the place. And there's, as far as I know, no such thing as a cold shot the way there's a flu shot.
There's not. No, there's so many. There's several different viruses that can cause the common cold. Mm. And they do change slightly so that they can keep making people sick. And so that's one way viruses perpetuate themselves is they make small changes in their protein coat so their immune system doesn't really recognize them as the thing they saw before, and they can still cause disease. So, yeah, the common cold is, you know, it's prevented by some really simple measures, washing your hands, staying home if you're sick, and covering your cough and making sure that you don't spread that through all those droplets that you sneeze across onto the console and then you touch it.
Exactly right. Yeah, I'll try not to sneeze on our mixing board here today. At least I hope I don't have a cold. We have a question that was submitted, and I'm seeing this on our screen here. This refers to the H1N1, which was a flu variety that was in the headlines a few years ago, definitely. And the question is, after H1N1 failed to become as globally destructive as was predicted, a lot of people thought the CDC and other organizations might have overreacted in trying to get the public prepared. How do you, as public health professionals, reach out to the public in a responsible manner without causing that sort of undue, my God, the death flu? You know, how do you strike that balance between making sure it's urgent and serious without being overly concerning? And either of you could take this.
Well, you have to remember one of our basis for comparison is the 1918 pandemic where I think it was 30 million people died from the influenza. And that's the basis. We do have pandemic plans in place that are frequently practiced. And with H1N1, we did see a lot of people, your atypical individuals that usually have ill effects from the flu that you know actually died. You know, people in the prime of their life, 20 and 30 year olds that died from complications from influenza. I think getting the message out that these vaccines are needed. I mean, who's to say that vaccinating the public and getting those messages out there that you need your vaccination didn't maybe help prevent some of those illnesses complications from influenza.
And I would add to that, you know, we don't know how severe a flu virus is going to be until we kind of see it unfold and how sick people get. And so, you know, with every response, we react based on the historic knowledge. When you have a totally new flu virus, people do tend to get more sick and more people tend to die. And so based on that historic knowledge, we reacted that way, but scaled it down very quickly as we learned about the virulence of that flu. And it is a balancing act. It's a real challenge that we face every day in public health when we're dealing with things that people may not be familiar with. You know, when you have to tell somebody they have tuberculosis, there's a lot of fear and concern among the family and friends. And so we do that on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Johnson, I want to talk to you for just a moment about the kinds of questions you ask in your line of work, because what we're talking about here with Dr. Buchanan and Ms. Sturm is how they go about asking the right questions to arrive at a solution that is ultimately helpful to the public. In your line of work as an infectious disease researcher, what are the questions you're asking to help build your knowledge of infectious diseases, and how do you apply that knowledge?
Well, with respect to influenza, we've engaged in quite a few studies since the pandemic. And what fascinated me about the pandemic was this prevalence that was spoken about, where young individuals, healthy individuals, did have severe disease. And I wanted to understand that more. And so we spend a lot of time trying to understand the molecular signatures that create a more virulent virus. And so we try to pull those apart. The other side of that is, when we can understand what those signatures are, then we can begin to identify what parts of the influenza we could attack using vaccines or using antivirals. So most of my therapeutic efforts have been towards small molecules and not necessarily vaccines. And it's amazing that in probably, what, the 50 or so years that people have been looking for antivirals for treatment, there have been few that have been found, except for those, you know, handful of viruses, HIV, HCV. So we still remain challenged to find effective therapeutics for most of these viruses, common viruses, influenza, the cold virus, and so forth.
And I would say, too, that probably complicates your job because, as we've talked about, the flu virus itself, if we may use the singular flu virus, there are multiple strains, and they do change from year to year. So it's like you're chasing a moving target, too.
Right. And I think our work, and the work of others, of course, substantiates that this initial wave that came back in 2009, there were different clades. I don't know how there were different groups, mm-hmm. different tribes of flu out there, right? And you know, eventually one became the major dominant species worldwide. And the reason it became the dominant species was because it was not too lethal and easy to spread. So understanding how these viruses transmit from person to person is extremely important, and something we don't really know much about.
Oh, that's fascinating. So your work continues on that. I want to switch gears for just a second to get to a related topic, and that's how we in the media are doing our jobs in helping you guys talk about these diseases to our viewers, our listeners, and our readers, whether it's online, television, radio, print. A peer-reviewed study that was published a few years ago in the journal Public Library of Science found that media reporting of diseases does have an effect on the way that media consumers, that is the viewers and the listeners and the readers, think about the severity of those diseases. And that is the specific finding of that study, was the more a disease was talked about on the news, the worse people thought it was. Like, they actually equated that with severity. So we've seen that borne out in so many of these instances, like swine flu or SARS or H1N1 and now Ebola, where there's a disease du jour that is just talked about incessantly, and then several months later, we don't hear anything else about it. There's relatively little follow-up. So let me, and we'll start with you, Dr. Johnson. As a doctor and as a researcher, what do you see on the news that really bugs you about the way diseases and viruses are talked about, and how do you think we can do a little bit better job of communicating better information to the public?
Well, I guess I've watched the news along with everyone, right? The national news, and I actually think that they did a really good job this year. They really helped to shed light on what was going on with Ebola and the problems. I know I thought they actually. They actually went into CDC's office where they have the situation room and, you know, asked questions. What's going on here? You know, why didn't CDC figure this out? And I think those are questions that in a society, democratic society like ours, we should be asking. Mm-hmm. You know, what went wrong? Why didn't we know what we knew?
Yeah.
Didn't we know what we know? Or why don't we know what we don't know?
Now we're starting to get into the realm of philosophy.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. But I
so,
think you're right. So
from my perspective, I haven't seen it, that. I thought the media did a really, really great job, at least in the Ebola cycle.
Oh, okay. Dr. Buchanan, what do you see? Whether it's Ebola or something a little more mundane, I mean, when you watch the news, or and you talk to the press a lot, I mean, mm-hmm. What is the message you hope we get out of this and report to our consumers?
I think when I watch the news or when I'm doing an interview or somebody locally is researching something, what really speaks to me is when they go to the source. They're not using somebody 3 people removed or somebody who really, that's not their level, area of expertise. But they fact check before they go on, and they get the information from the source, the CDC or their local health department or a local expert, and that's really speaks to me. And you know, scaling it based on true risk or true concern is also important. But that fact checking and making sure they know before they go live with something or they write an article, fact checking is really important.
And Ms. Sturm, for you, I mean, what is it you see when you watch the news? What are we getting right? What are we getting wrong when we talk about diseases?
Well, you know, on the local level, I would like to say that the media is often a very valuable resource for us to get information out to the public quickly. We have a great relationship with them, and our PIO is fantastic at getting that information out. And I think that I would also like to second what Dr. Johnson said, that I think so far that they've done a terrific job with Ebola.
See, that's interesting because I wasn't prepared for you guys to all agree on that. I would have thought that somebody here would have said, by gum, they're inflaming the, you know, throwing fuel on the fire of terror, but you guys seem to think that we're doing an okay job right now with this.
I'll have to disagree with my comrades.
Uh-oh.
I certainly think that some of the coverage, especially the national coverage, has been a little inflammatory.
Oh.
You know, they keep going back to the pictures of people being carried away in Africa in, you know, in bags and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, when they're talking about the U.S., they're showing pictures of Africa or the extreme stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, we're not doing that here. So so that sent a mixed message to the public because we keep seeing these people in Tyvek and spraying things down. But we're really talking about something going on in the U.S., and that's not happening in the U.S. So I think there have been times when you have that. They're using newsreel that they have.
Right, right.
But it's not actually what's going on here.
The picture may not match the message.
Exactly.
Okay, interesting stuff.
Go ahead, Dr. I can make one comment that I guess the reason that I feel better about this coverage is that I've been through other coverages. HIV coverage was difficult for people, and AIDS, right? So and then from there in New Mexico we had the coverage of the Hantavirus outbreak back in 1993, and at that point the media picked that up, and it was a mysterious Navajo disease. And so those are the types of things that you know, whether it's, you know, I guess branding of a disease, oh well, that's a disease of these people,
right
or that's a disease of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not seeing that this time. And so that could have happened in Africa. And maybe that's why we have concern right now here in the United States, because we actually had one of our own have that disease. And, oh, gosh, it could come here. Mm. And so then we start to pay attention. But oftentimes, you know, the perspective is, well, that's those people.
Right.
That's those people in Africa, and that's their problem. And I've heard that. And that's not going to help us. We're really a global culture now. And that's something we've all got to get our heads around, and how we're going to begin to work together to manage the fact that we don't really have borders. And many, many people said that it doesn't matter if you stop all the flights and so forth, because that's just not going to impact it.
All right. Well, we're going to go to the phones for one question. We have a Bill on the line from Knoxville. This gets back to a subject we were talking about just a little bit earlier about flu shots. Bill, you're on Dialogue. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right. Go right ahead with your question.
I am a psychologist, primarily treating geriatric patients, and over the years I've seen a number of patients with transverse myelitis attributed to flu shots, and I would wonder if you would comment on that.
Sure thing. I'll take it to our guests here. Dr. Buchanan, is there a connection there?
I haven't seen a study that connects transverse myelitis with flu vaccination. Certainly could be one out there that I'm not familiar with. Certainly have seen studies that have connected some flu vaccinations to what's called Guillain-Barré syndrome, but that's something different. So I'm not familiar with that connection.
Okay, very good. And Bill, thank you so much for your question. We do appreciate that. We're going to pause right now for a station break. We're back in 60 seconds at 20 minutes before 2 o'clock. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Time now is 1:41 on this rainy, gloomy Wednesday afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us, listening in for Dialogue here from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and if you're just joining us, our subject is communicable diseases, infectious diseases, and how they affect our communities. We're joined on the phone by Dr. Colleen Johnson. She's an infectious disease researcher and specialist at the University of Louisville. In the studio, we have Martha Buchanan, the director of the Knox County Health Department, and Roberta Sturm, who's an emergency preparedness epidemiologist with the health department. And so welcome back, everybody. And if you have a question for us, 974-5050 is the number, at WUOTFM on Twitter, facebook.com/WUOTFM. I want to spend the balance of the program talking about an issue that faces many of us because it's being reported on a lot. It's something that's an issue of topical concern, and that is a burgeoning movement in some parts of the nation, among some folks, parents who elect not to vaccinate their children. I think it's a fascinating phenomenon. Many health officials across the country have warned against the practice on the grounds that it does far more harm than it does good. So let's just kind of walk through this issue a little bit, since it does apply directly to the spread of communicable diseases. So I guess we could start with you, Dr. Johnson. You research infectious diseases and how they spread. Let's talk about, to give us a grounding here, a communicable disease spreads very rapidly or can spread very rapidly. Dr. Buchanan mentioned earlier, especially with things like the flu, can go through children very, very quickly. So if parents are not vaccinating children, what are some of the risks that doctors talk about occurring?
Well, that certainly they can perpetuate the whatever virus or bacterial illness that is in their community and amongst their friends and create little small focal epidemics. And I believe I refer to Dr. Buchanan, there's been epidemics that we haven't seen in years of whooping cough. Is that correct?
Yes, we've had.
In certain parts of the country?
Mm-hmm. There have been. And then even here in Tennessee, our rates of whooping cough are up about 300%.
Whoa.
Sometimes connected back to unvaccinated children. But a lot of that's also connected to waning of immunity. So adults are getting it and giving it back to children who haven't yet been vaccinated. So that's part of the challenge with the whooping cough. But most recently, we've had some measles outbreaks around the United States and a very small outbreak here in Tennessee related to non-vaccinated folks and folks who choose not to vaccinate. So somebody in that community travels where there's measles disease, they get the disease and they bring it back, and there's a pocket of people who aren't vaccinated, and those folks all become sick, and some become rather sick and require hospitalization, and it can spread to others who can't yet be vaccinated. So, there are age requirements for vaccine, and so little tiny children and babies and infants who haven't been vaccinated yet could get the disease, and they're at great risk for severe complications. So that's where we have concerns where they bring it back and spread that to those who haven't either can't be vaccinated yet or have chosen not to be vaccinated.
Well, this gets to an important point, too, that I want to bring up, which is that one of the terms that epidemiologists and disease researchers use in when they're talking about vaccinations is a concept called herd immunity. And we hear this term a lot, but let's explain what that means. What is herd immunity, and why does it matter?
When you're looking at herd immunity, you either want a portion of your community to either be vaccinated or to already have had an illness to where they develop immunity. So that way it protects those individuals that either are immunocompromised and cannot be vaccinated, or like Dr. Buchanan said, they're too young to vaccinate. So once you have enough of the population vaccinated, then it's harder for that disease to come into a community and wreak havoc.
We were talking about this with the flu vaccine a little earlier, that the more people get vaccinated, it can prevent an even worse outbreak that might otherwise occur. Is that right?
Yeah. Right. It just breaks that chain of transmission. So if you get exposed to somebody with a disease, but you're immune because you got vaccinated or you already had the disease, then you can't pass it to the newborn child at your home.
Yeah. So as we talk about herd immunity and its role in community health, how important would you say it is in community health? I mean, this sounds like it might be even be like a cornerstone of preventing disease outbreaks in a city, a densely populated area like Chicago or San Francisco, New York, or even Knoxville for that matter.
Well, I do feel it's important. When you start breaking down herd immunity, you do have things like measles outbreaks. You do see things like increases in whooping cough or pertussis. And that's kind of what we're seeing now, is because we're not Tennessee specifically, but there are states that their vaccination rates are so low that they are seeing more incidences of vaccine preventable illness.
Before we move on, I wanted to go back just for a second to our media coverage topic. We have Betty on the line from Knoxville, and she had a question or a comment for the panel. Betty, go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. Now, to the comments that were made about the news media, maybe some people did get the impression that they'd heard enough, but it's my opinion that people, just because I hear something on the news or TV about something as terrible as this, so far away, that it takes them more than once to hear it to realize that, hey, this is real, for it to really sink in, because most people are not paying attention. And it's in the beginning stages that you need to pay attention, as you said, the HIV. So I don't mind hearing it over and over, because you are right again. The world, it seems to be, we say, the world is getting smaller. Well, it isn't. It's just that we know more about what's going on in so many more places now. So we need to hear it over and over. I think it takes more than once before someone really latches on to the thought, hey, this is real. And just because you are out, you have not traveled, you don't know who you might brush against, touch something they just touched, that body fluid, whatever. And you're innocent. They are innocent. Maybe they don't even know they are sick at that time. Now, let me see. I had another thought on that line, too. But one other question I want to ask. About maybe a month ago, I just happened to be watching TV that I don't get to see much of. And there was, they showed a map of the United States, and apparently didn't get in on the very beginning of what was being said. But they showed the state of Tennessee in a light color blue, and the same color of a lot of the western states, maybe from, say, Texas, up a line up there. And I thought they were talking about an infectious disease.
Well, let me take that question, Betty, to our panel. And actually, what you might be referring to is something we haven't even talked about in this enterovirus, something we talked about affecting mainly young people. I don't know much about it, but let's branch out to that for just a second. Enterovirus?
Enterovirus D68.
Thank you.
It's the virus that we're seeing among young adolescent children, and in particular kids with asthma who are getting very sick and going to the hospital. Enterovirus is one of those. There's a bunch of enteroviruses. D68 is just one of them.
Oh.
And they cause everything from a rash to respiratory illness. And this particular strain, D68, causes everything from mild illness to severe illness. And what's kind of interesting is that the states all around Tennessee have had several cases. And we actually haven't had very many at all here in Tennessee.
Hmm.
And so it's been kind of interesting to watch the map develop on that. That may be what she was referring to.
Yeah.
Having not seen that, it's hard to say, but that's what came to our minds about enterovirus D68, which we continue not to see a large number of cases here in Tennessee.
But something that I'm sure you're keeping an eye on to see how it does develop.
We are, and the testing, it takes time, but yes, we are keeping an eye on that.
Okay, very good. Well, let's go back to, we had a topic just a moment ago talking about the anti-vaccination theories and movements here in the United States. Have you and your colleagues in the Knox County Health Department seen or heard anything that indicates the prevalence, the amount of people who might be feeling that way here in East Tennessee? Because usually when I hear about it, just anecdotally, it's usually articles coming out of Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, Seattle, larger cities generally in other parts of the country. What about here in East Tennessee? What have you heard about that?
Well, you know, when we do our, we actually do audits of vaccines for daycares and pediatricians' offices who participate in the Vaccines for Children's program. And when we look at that, we record the documentation of who's exempt and who's not exempt. And what we see is we see several kids and families who choose to be vaccine exempt for religious reasons, which is the predominant reason we see here in East Tennessee. And then some folks who, of course, are medically exempt, and that's a different exemption, but they're not as prominent as those with religious exemption. And honestly, we're not seeing a big change in that. It's kind of staying steady here, which is not unusual for the Southeast to kind of lag behind sometimes in trending, but we don't see a lot of that, but we certainly see that. And when we see that, we respect their right for that, but also provide them with information, education, so they can make that informed decision for themselves and their families.
Turning to your line of work, Dr. Johnson, as you research infectious diseases, has your research intersected any of these areas of declining to vaccine children?
No. I mean, so I'm on the other side, you know, looking for the therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly heard about the arguments. Unfortunately, most of those arguments were argued against and shown to be not based on fact. And unfortunately, that doesn't, maybe that's what the news should be getting out with.
Well, and
right?
That's,
I mean, because there was a lot of play about the book that I think a couple individuals wrote on vaccines and their problems.
Mm-hmm.
No one's written a book, I guess, that's gotten enough attention
In favor
showing
of
that vaccines
them.
Indeed are fine.
Right. Well, Ms. Sturm, let's go to you as an epidemiologist at KCHD and someone who's involved in something as even as mundane as flu vaccines, but we're talking about different kinds here. What are your concerns as we talk about the thing that Dr. Johnson just brought up, the theories behind, well, I'm not going to vaccinate my child because it does this or it doesn't do that. Help us bust some myths here. What get behind the headline here. What do we need to know about vaccinations and why they're beneficial as opposed to harmful?
Oh, wow. They're beneficial for a number of reasons. It keeps our kids in school. It keeps, you know, our babies healthy. But I also feel that there's this big problem with misinformation out there. There's this lack of trust, I guess, which concerns me. But, you can Google anything and come up with hundreds of thousands of different websites telling you that vaccines are bad or wrong or bad for your child, but they're not really very well founded.
Mm-hmm.
And that concerns me because it's we're at an age where we're so overly informed that I think we really miss the important information that vaccines are good, are healthy.
I was about to say that gets to an important point, and I see this as a journalist all the time in different realms. You can sort of create your own media bubble if you want to, something that reflects only that which you already believe, only that which makes you comfortable. So if I'm a parent and my kid is getting ready to go into school or something like that, and I'm debating this vaccine question, where do I go to find that good information?
I think the best source of information would be the CDC's website.
Mm.
And there's lots of information. They even talk about the pros and cons of vaccination and have the data there to show that vaccinating is safe. It has not ever been proven to be connected to any illness or cause anything in children. And that, you know, the other side that we forget, because we haven't had polio in the United States in a really long time.
Right.
Vaccination helped eradicate polio. We don't have measles and mumps very often in this country because of vaccination.
And smallpox.
And smallpox has been eradicated from the world. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just don't see those diseases anymore, and that's because of vaccination.
Well, let me ask, that segues right into my next point, which is considering the 200-year-long record of successful inoculation, starting with a British physician named Edward Jenner back in the late 1700s who came up with the concept of vaccinations. Why is this movement then so persistent, and why is it gaining traction now when we have this marvelous two-century track record of successes, like the ones you're talking about with polio and smallpox?
Well, it's just my theory that, you know, I think it's always been there. We just, because of information sharing, we all have more awareness of it. And, you know, there's always been those folks who choose not to vaccinate their children, mm-hmm. and they're always going to be there. And maybe it's not getting more traction, it's just getting more attention.
And we also don't, you know, we live in an age now where we don't remember how bad whooping cough was. We don't know how bad some of these vaccine-preventable diseases were in children. You know, we didn't see children die. We didn't see children, you know, I don't know anyone who died from polio or had ill effects from polio. And that's something that this generation really has never witnessed.
And Dr. Johnson, did you want to add anything on to that particular subject?
No, I mean, I agree. I think it's out of sight, out of mind, right? So
it's easier to sort of put it in a box somewhere and think, well, this isn't going to be a problem,
yeah,
because it hasn't
been
a problem.
We're not having any problems, so we don't need that vaccine and we don't remember the way it was.
Mm. Back, I mean, only as recently as, say 50 years ago, really. I mean,
Right. The only people we know that have side effects from polio are adults,
right,
who might have a limp or something. You know?
Although it's fascinating to know that it used to be called infantile paralysis because it did affect children a lot.
Right. Nobody's seen a child in an iron lung in this country in a really long time.
We hope it doesn't happen again.
Absolutely.
That's definitely true as well. Any final thoughts? And we'll start with you, Ms. Sturm, as we're talking about any of the subjects we've talked about today, anything that we didn't get to you'd like to mention before we go.
Health Department is a great resource for information. Feel free to give us a call.
And get your flu shot.
Absolutely.
All right. Dr. Buchanan, final thoughts?
You know, good prevention is always a good rule of thumb.
Exactly right. And Dr. Johnson, anything?
Give to your WHO.
Absolutely right. Yeah, no, that's interesting stuff. And so let me ask you this, though, while we have you on the line. You have a new post that's coming up starting in January. You're going to be coming from Kentucky down to the cool green hills of Tennessee to lead the National Institute of Mathematical and Biological Synthesis. Tell us a little bit about what you plan to do when you get down here in January.
Right. I'm really, really looking forward to being in Knoxville and working with all the great scientists that you have there at UT. So my charge is to try to step into the footsteps of Lou Gross and continue the way to build relationships between mathematicians and biologists and integrate their research perspectives so that they can learn from one another. And that's very powerful. If we think about it just in terms of what we talked about today, wouldn't it be cool if we had predictive models, mathematical models, that would help us predict outbreaks of disease and how to intervene
in effective ways.
So, I mean, that's something we could do. Not that that's what the group's doing there, but it's an example of integrating math and biology to address a problem in society.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, Dr. Buchanan of the County Health Department, and Roberta Sturm as well. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, 91.9 FM WUOT and WUOT HD1 Knoxville. At 2:00, time for Afternoon Concert with Whitney Dodds.